Hello and welcome to Focus on Business. I'm your host, Lee Strickland. Today's guest is Robert Roskin, social entrepreneur, author, and founder owner of Oasis Carbro, located at Carmel. And I want to tell you a little bit about Robert and a little bit about Oasis. The Oasis operates as a traditional coffee, cafe, tea, and wine lounge. You can come alone or with friends and enjoy the relaxing environment. At night, the Oasis transforms into an environment of entertainment, connections, and inspiration. On weeknights, the Oasis hosts a broad range of speakers on love-based subjects. On Friday nights, movies that matter. And on Saturday nights, they do nights of heart-centered music. Robert has authored 10 books that spread a message of unconditional love for all. And titles include The Spirit of Business, and he just brought me a copy of that today. I am so honored. And Robert and his wife, Julia, and their daughter, Alicia, have organized and hosted 74 One Love events in Jamaica, on Native American reservations, on college campuses, and at public venues all over the United States. These are all non-commercial, involved no sponsorship funding, and are free to the public. They're non-denominational, apolitical, and bring forward a message of universal love. He also hosted and organized the Bob Marley birthday celebration in Kingston, Jamaica, with a live audience of tens of thousands of TV and radio, of almost two million people, yeah. Not dollars, sorry. Yeah. And these events have led to community-wide healing. Robert, you are obviously a social entrepreneur at heart.
Thank you. I like that term. I'll claim it.
Yeah, yeah, and claim it, because you're out there, you're mixing business with your belief systems. You started a coffee shop that's around that spiritual perspective that you have, but it's not a nonprofit, correct?
No, I've run nonprofits. I've had several nonprofits, and I have a nonprofit now, but the coffee house, we all have our bills at the end of the month.
Oh, yes.
And so
more and more.
Yeah, exactly. So when I started the coffee house, I knew that I wanted it to be self-sustaining, not only pay all of its expenses, but pay my needs as well. So I started it about 2.5 years ago, and it was profitable from day one.
And so what was your concept with deciding to start a coffee shop and then coming up with the name, the theme, and all of that? How did you do that?
Well, you know, as you just mentioned in there, for the last, up until I started the coffee house, there was a 12-year period where I did nothing but philanthropic work. And that was bringing a message of unconditional love, one love, agape, the same love Jesus talked about, many other spiritual teachers, Martin Luther King, into prisons, into the Native American reservations, and into the ghettos of Jamaica. And spent the better part of my life savings doing that, which I'm very pleased to do. And then about 3 years ago, I thought, all right, I want to, instead of having to go to create each event, go to Jamaica or go to Arizona,
right.
I wanted to stabilize myself in one community.
You wanted an anchor.
I wanted an anchor, and I wanted something.
In the best way.
In the best way, yeah. I wanted a spiritual anchor, a logistical anchor.
Right.
I wanted to stop traveling so much, and I wanted something that would pay its own needs, because I had pretty much paid what I could
right.
afford to give to the world.
So now, are you a native of this area, or where are you from?
Well, I started here as a college kid in 65.
Okay.
So I've spent about a half of my life in Chapel Hill. I raised my daughter here. I was a business person here. I ran 2 or 3 businesses here that, you know, down the street. And I was a hippie here back in the days.
Okay.
So I've gone through many incarnations.
I've seen many hippies become great business people, which is what you've done.
Yeah. Well, I think the spirit of independence that, you know, the fact that we began as 20-something, not wanting to enter into what we call the establishment.
Right.
We didn't want to spend our day.
The man.
Yeah, exactly. So when it came to, but then the needs of money crept in, especially.
Reality.
Right. Especially once you had kids, you know, and then you thought, well, I got to make money. And then that independence often took the form of entrepreneur.
Right, because then you can kind of create the world that you want, the world that you envision, the products, the Oasis, for instance.
Yeah. Right? And you got to remember, back in that day, there was no solar, there was no Weaver Street, there was no yoga, there was no acupuncture, there was no holistic health.
Right.
None of that existed when we started out. And we had to find viable alternatives to a profit-making based system.
Right. So there really was nothing. You were either in business or you were in nonprofits,
that's right.
charities type stuff. There was no social entrepreneurship that combined the two.
Yeah, we were calling it at the time, Lee, Right Livelihood.
Okay. Right, I've never heard that.
Yeah,
okay.
Right Livelihood. That means a you need to make money, but a livelihood that makes a contribution.
Okay.
Social entrepreneurship is the same thing.
All right. And so you sat down, you decided we're gonna put our roots down again and put an anchor here in Carrboro. And why a coffee shop?
Believe it or not, 45 years ago, I tried to open this shop. 45 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Where Bredman's is. There was a yellow house there, and my vision was to open a counterculture coffee shop that would be more than just a coffee shop. It would be a nice place to chill. It would offer art. It would offer music. It would offer inspiration like I'm doing now.
Right.
And I rented the building, and I started to redo it, but the founding fathers of Chapel Hill, leaders,
yeah,
for some reason didn't want a hippie coffee shop in the middle of their town in 1968.
Oh, if they only knew, right?
If only. So they kept throwing regulation after me until I was a 20-something-year-old kid, so I folded.
Right.
Then at 60-something, when I thought, well, what would I like for the next chapter of my life, I decided I'd like to come back here and implement the idea that's been marinating now for 40 years.
So it's going back to where your heart was, your passion was as a 20-something. And so you're making a lot of points. You're a social entrepreneur. You're combining your beliefs with your business. You're a baby boomer entrepreneur, mm-hmm. right? Starting something new in your 60s. You're one of the sandwich generations, too, because you're talking, your daughter's 19, 20, somewhere.
She's 28.
Oh, okay, because your bio said she was 19. So, okay, so that's been a few years since your bio has been updated.
Yeah. Thank you.
And so you're dealing with all those dynamics. You've got essentially a millennial. She's nearly a millennial.
Let me tell you what she does. She anchors a calm, conscious spot in Charlotte. She operates the number one yoga studio in Charlotte. It's been chosen. She's been open 3 years. She's been number one yoga studio for 2 of the 3 years. She has 20
years. Well, I'm the first year now. I'm just kidding. I mean, that's amazing to start a business to build that kind of brand
in that
amount of time.
And so quickly. She has 20 yoga teachers. She has 48 classes a week. And she has 2 yoga rooms. She has 2 massage therapy rooms with 6 massage therapists working out of it. And in that place, she also has a coffee tea lounge, and she calls it Okra.
Okay.
Now, she got a beautiful name, Okra.
Okra. That's yoga, that's definitely a Southern name.
Yeah, yoga, massage, and tea. And then 6 months ago, she opened that 3 years ago before I opened mine. 6 months ago, she opened an organic, sustainable, fair trade clothing and body lotions, body care store, and she calls that Gumbo.
Oh, I love it. So you've obviously passed that social entrepreneur gene on to her.
Me and many others that influenced her. She has 4 Rastafarian grandfathers in Jamaica. She has a Mayan grandfather. We were all writing these books with these elders. She has a Mayan grandfather from Guatemala. She has spoken at 50 events in Jamaica to the kids about One Love. She's, like you mentioned, she opened Bob Marley's 60th birthday in his hometown of Kingston in 2005. So she has been formed from a very young age to know that she came to this planet to teach and learn love.
Right.
Get on with the business at hand.
And combining that, because I think that's one of the things I know some of my clients have said, I was honest to a fault. And I thought, well, I guess that's a good fault to have. But it's like, if you have that integrity in how you do business and you're authentic with your belief system, and ours don't necessarily align, but if you're operating from that good place, then your business reflects that. Your customers come. There's a different atmosphere to how you do business. And you're as likely to get a call from your client whenever they're going through an ugly divorce as you are when they need their financial statements done, right?
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
You know, and it's that kind of thing. So, again, you decided 45 years ago you had the idea. You decided to come here. You chose Carmel to locate it there. And if someone walked into Oasis, what would they find about Oasis that's different than other coffee shops?
Well, one is, I think it's the most beautiful chill spot in Raleigh-Durham area.
Okay.
It's 13-foot ceilings. It's all wood and overstuffed leather furniture. Everything is hand-done. As your eye scans the environment, there's no corporate signs. Everything is handmade. There's very pleasant, easy music going. Half the area is set off for no Wi-Fi.
Okay.
So it's not a, you can come in and get on the Wi-Fi, and a lot of the, especially young people do, or people that are having meetings, but it's not a Wi-Fi. Like, I just went down to the coffee shop two doors down
right.
from us. Everyone there is in Wi-Fi.
And it, and everybody's on their phone, their computer, and another device. There's at least three devices. I was just down there a while ago, and I thought, I have to get out of here.
Yeah, exactly. And if you're going to have a conversation, you're interrupting everybody else.
Right.
Well, I put the whole front area where the nice leather seats are on the comfortable chairs. This is for speaking to other friends, talking to friends. This is for reading a book. This is a non-Wi-Fi
area. It's for
area.
That old-fashioned eye-to-eye contact type thing.
Yeah, and you got to remember, up until about 15 years ago, every coffee shop on the planet was extroverted.
Right.
You would go get caffeinated up and talk till late into the night. When Wi-Fi came 15 years ago, it became introverted.
Right.
And we have a generation of people who don't, who see coffee shops as an introverted place to go be by yourself with electronics. Well, so the one thing you notice differently is my place, this conversation is going on, there are people reading books, and I have a platform where you can sit on the carpet on pillows with a little fake fireplace in the summer and a waterfall in the, excuse me, in the winter and a waterfall in the summer that holds about 8 or 10 people. So you can sit, a lot of the young people come in there and they sit on a, you know, on the floor, on the carpet. So the first thing you'd notice is it's not a Wi-Fi cafe.
All right.
Okay. And I do, and it's all vegetarian. I have vegetarian meals. And I have organic coffee, tea, you know, things like that, beer and wine too. And so during the day, you would walk in and see a physically stunningly beautiful, people walk in and their mouth comes up, it
right.
drops open, stunningly beautiful place. And you would notice that there's a different ambiance. At night, it's totally different. You know, last night I showed a movie with Wayne Dyer, The Shift. Tonight we have a thing on Bernie Sanders, a phone bank for Bernie Sanders. That's the only political thing I've ever got involved in. Tomorrow night I have a meditation teacher. So at 7 o'clock I stop serving, and on weeknights from 7 to 8 I have anyone who has a love-based subject.
Okay.
Anyone who's bringing love into the community can use this as a platform to get that message out.
So it could be a poet, it could be a musician, it can be author, it can be anyone that wants to come in and talk about improving the world through some kind of love action.
Exactly. I have a poetry slam night, you know, open mic night once
okay.
a month. I have an author coming who wrote a book out of Brazil coming up this week or next week. You know, yoga, meditation, anything that's life affirmative. Anything that's
okay.
life affirmative.
So you're open 7 days a week?
7 days a week. And then on Friday night, I have what I call movies that matter.
Right.
And there's a woman coming in this Friday night whose movie was just on Hallmark Hall of Fame on Thanksgiving night.
Okay.
So it's called I Hope You Dance.
All right.
And she's going
off
to
of the Leanne Womack music.
Pardon me?
The song Leanne Womack sang, right?
Yeah, and it's Hallmark Hall of Fame did a story on four miracle situations, and she, Suzette Faith Foster, is one of the four. She'll be there Friday night showing the movie, signing her book, talking. And then on Saturday night, I have a musical group from the Congo.
Okay.
You know. And
very diverse.
Very,
something,
you know,
for everybody.
As long as it's life affirmative.
Right.
What I don't do, not because I think you shouldn't, but it's not my tribe, I don't bring in subjects that leave people angry and depressed, like
okay.
fracking, like GMOs, like the political things that do, like the problems of the world. Not because I think we don't need that. We do.
It's just not your place.
It's not my tribe. My
right.
tribe is the answer tribe. The, you know what I mean? My
okay.
answer clan. The other clan is the problem. They point, here's the problem. We're polluting the planet. Corruption everywhere.
So you truly named it Oasis to reflect that you wanted it to be an oasis to go to work. Because in the desert, you go to an oasis for food, water, shelter, and a place to get away from the harsh environment.
Yeah, and what I wanted, which I think is alignment with your beliefs too, I wanted a place where people could come, whether they know it or not, whether they're coming for a presentation that deals with it directly or just sitting in the place having a cup of tea or coffee,
right.
where they can remember why they are here. Which is to learn and teach love.
Right.
Which every great master, definitely the greatest master of all, Jesus,
right.
has taught. You know, so what I wanted is a place where people could remember that. And whether they, and there's books sitting around that are free to read that bring that message. The music is pretty much in line with that, though there is a lot of codependent love songs from my generation. Joni Mitchell, Joan Baez, James Taylor. Because James Taylor was from here, so right. It's only appropriate.
You got to play some of the local ones. Yeah. So if someone was thinking about, you know, they're being a social entrepreneur, they're passionate about something, whether it's in the problem or the solution side, what would you tell them about making the decision to keep it a for-profit versus being a nonprofit, since you've done both?
I have. I ran a school in Berkeley that was nonprofit that's called the Owner Builder Center. One thing to know is when you become nonprofit, you no longer own it. It's owned by the state.
Yeah, there are no owners, so it's for a public benefit.
Yes, yeah, so it's owned by the state, which means you
lose
give up
control.
That's right. It's not right. yours. It's the state's.
Right.
And you have to wrestle with that. Are you willing to do that? Nonprofit opens you up to, if you're 501c3, to get donations that are tax right. exempt. If you're not 501c3, you still can get donations.
But they're just not tax deductible for the donator, right?
But I would think, I don't think that, I think you can do a profit making from greater clarity or equal clarity as a nonprofit.
Well, right. Paul Newman had started a for-profit that gives its profits to charity.
Yes.
And so he maintained control. And it's essentially, I think that's more my philosophy, because I've seen too many nonprofits and I love them. And I love working with them. When the board can go one way and it's not what was the ultimate mission, because the board changes and you think everybody's on the same page and suddenly they're not and the mission gets hijacked.
Yeah, and I wouldn't think that you need to start a nonprofit out of thinking it needs to reflect your spiritual or your life beliefs. You can do that in either category.
Right.
You have to have a business reason to go one or the other. So I wouldn't say that, you know, there's a lot of nonprofits that operate on a lot baser level
right.
than a lot of profit making. One thing I've learned is this, is if you're doing visionary business means you've been given a vision. A vision is seldom given to a committee.
Correct.
A vision is given to one, occasionally two people. But if it's your vision, you have to take full control for that and full responsibility. So to me, if you're working at a visionary level, like you feel like you've been sent to this planet to do this work, then I find as if you give that, and many visionaries are very inclusive people. They include everybody.
Right. You can share somebody in the mission of making that vision happen, but you still have to have ownership of that vision to make sure everybody stays on point.
That's right. It's your vision.
Right.
And one time Bob Marley, when he started to make some romantic love song, when he fell in love, after making very revolutionary songs about the establishment and everything, somebody said to Bob, you know, you're veering off course. His comment was, my music is my music.
Right.
You know, well, your vision is your vision. It's not the group's vision. So if you're working at a visionary level, which
right.
I think you do and many people you talk to do, once you become nonprofit, you've given up ownership of the vision.
Right. And it's vulnerable to being hijacked or restricted either by the board or by the government and saying, you know,
exactly.
what you can or cannot do is that within your mission and those kind of things.
And the two great examples of that, when Martin Luther King started speaking out on the Vietnam War, everyone in his nonprofit organization freaked out and said, Martin, if you go into international affairs and condemn our government instead of staying, you know,
right.
local, then we're going to lose all of our donors and we're not going to be able to get our salaries paid. And they all fought him for speaking out against
right.
the Vietnam War. So that was a great example of where his board members couldn't hold the vision of what they were doing. They were worried. The other thing is Mother Teresa, when she had the nonprofit formed, it became somewhat corrupted, very, you know, mercenary and very ego. And one day she walked in and just dismissed it. So that's
right.
it.
Well, and that's something that happens because any organization starts for a purpose, whether it's a business, you know, you're the local coffee shop and suddenly you decide to franchise it and it goes everywhere and it loses the heart that originally had. Or a nonprofit can be out there doing it and the governments are the same way. They become protective of their own existence. They take on a life of their own. And so it's not about what their mission was or what the vision was. It's about keeping things going so the salaries can be paid and that they always exist or those kind of things. So their mission then becomes to continue to exist.
It is. And the bigger they get, right. As you know, the bigger they get, the more that happens. A guy did a documentary recently. He went and interviewed all the main ecological, Sierra Club and stuff.
Right.
None of them were willing to mention the fact that the meat industry is the biggest polluter on the planet. Because they said, if we start telling people to stop eating meat, we're going to lose our donors.
Right.
So all of them avoided that one area.
Or it's like the ASPCA. We see all the commercials give the donations. But the fact is, if you give it to the one you see the commercial for on TV, the money does not go to your local ASPCA.
It doesn't.
If you want to save a pet, you need to save locally and donate locally and support versus that lovely, well-produced, well-paid media campaign that's out there that you get a T-shirt from. And that does not save a cat, a dog, or anybody else.
Yeah.
Right.
So I would say, in choosing whether you want to go nonprofit or profit, one key question to ask yourself, is your funding going to be easier if you go nonprofit? Do you have donors who will donate? Can you do the fundraisers? Or will you be easier to find open-hearted investors who will invest money in the hopes of making a return on the money?
And another question with that is, are you looking to individuals to donate, or are you looking to organizations to donate? Because as a business, if I give you $100, it's advertising, it's marketing, it's a sponsorship.
Yeah.
If I'm an individual and I give it to you and you're not a nonprofit that's 501c3, it doesn't have the effect. So you have to understand what's the motivation of who's donating or funding you to.
Yeah, and also, I've run six businesses. This is my sixth one. Two nonprofits, and the other four were profits. Three failed, one broke even, and two made it. Fortunately, the one that made it let me retire at 42.
Okay.
I'm now 68. So at 42, I was able to retire from the one that made
right.
it. That was a how-to video business, showing you how to do plumbing, electrical.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Things like that. I had a show on
back PBS. When it was VHS?
Yes. Back when there were video stores and there were VHS.
For the millennials, that was that stuff in that little black box that had little strings of plastic running through it, or nylon or whatever it was that held it. So, yes.
Yeah, back in those days. But what I've learned is this, is you can't just have a dream that you want to run your own business. You have to ask yourself, do you have the temperament to be an entrepreneur? Can you live without a guaranteed paycheck?
Can
your family? Are you risk adverse or are you pro risk? Can you, in other words, I never encourage people to become entrepreneurs unless I can deeply sense they have that personality. And that's a rare personality. My daughter has it. I have it. Many people don't have it. And it's not to say it's the bad thing. Some people are great with kids. Some people
right.
are great with elderly, sick, whatever.
Everybody has a different gift.
Yeah, God gives everyone a different gift. An entrepreneur may not be yours. Doesn't mean you can't make a huge contribution wherever you're working. It's just that, everyone has a vision. Wouldn't it be great to run my whatever?
Right.
But the number of people that can take the risk and...
Right. And wear all the hats and the stress. And, it's not always 9 to 5. It might be 9 to 5, 9 on Monday to 5 on Sunday.
Yeah.
Right? It doesn't stop. Well, and something else to think about that comes to mind in that is that whether you're a for-profit or a nonprofit, you have to be in it to make money or you don't sustain.
That's right.
And so that's one of the questions I ask when someone says, well, I need help starting this. I said, okay, are you in it for the money? Are you in it for the cause? Are you in it for, I'm in it for the cause. And it's like, well, you better be in it for the money because the cause isn't going to survive without the money. That's just the reality. So how do you help your daughter, other people you've done in your business, how have you reconciled that you have to have a profit motive, whether you're for-profit or nonprofit?
Well, my daughter did not ask for my help in that area.
Uh-oh.
And, she just had a vision of opening this place. She put every cent she had saved. She did Teach for America. She had saved some money from that. She had some of her own savings. She took over her student loan and from me, so I gave her that money and said, here, it's yours now. And she spent 4 months and $40,000 outfitting the building. She was 24 at the time.
Okay.
Huge risk. And no one had ever done this. Yoga studios traditionally do not make money. But her vision was to have a yoga studio, massage therapy, coffee, tea lounge. That it would be not just a place you go for your calm and your consciousness. So But she was the number one accounting major at Wilmington when she was there.
So she too has that dual artistic visionary with the practical business aspect.
Yeah. And so she knew how to run the numbers. She knew how to do the spreadsheets and everything.
Right.
And she understandably wanted me to back off because she wanted to know that whatever she did, it was hers. And I told her, I said, great. You do it. And if you need any of my advice, let me know. She needed very little.
Right. You were a safety net, not a hammock.
Yeah. And get this, 3 years into it, she's now selling it.
Oh, wow. That's successful.
Because she's going to put it up for sale soon, because entrepreneurs love to create. They don't particularly love to administer.
You don't like the routine of every day. So it's like someone says, well, you'll build a spreadsheet or you come in and create the account. So I was like, absolutely. But do not ask me to do debits and credits every day. I will lose my mind.
That's right. And so now her job has been making sure the payroll checks get out, making sure the ads get out, doing all that administrative. She's a yoga teacher, so she loves the hours during the week when she teaches yoga. But 85% of her job has become the mundane administration
Routine,
of the work. Now, I have the opposite feeling over here at Oasis. Oasis is pretty much a one-man person operation. When we have the busy weekend nights, I have a second person.
Okay.
Basically, one person can run it. It's only 1,000 square feet. And my view is I did not want to be a business person. I wanted to be a host. I wanted to create an environment where people could relax, and I wanted to host it. So I go in every day, and no more than 10% of my day is spent administering. You know, going to Whole Foods and picking up what I need, ordering things on the internet. 90% of my day is being there, being at the barista station, greeting people, being with them. If they want to discuss something, I'm there.
You're the bartender.
I'm like a conscious bartender. And you'll love this. I just have introduced this summer Kava.
Okay.
Kava is, I think, the creator's alternative to alcohol. Kava is the relaxation you seek from alcohol, the sociability, without the addiction, without the driving impairment, without the foggy
mind. So what is Kava?
Kava is a organic root that comes out of the South Pacific. There's a Kava bar right past Wendy's.
Okay.
Now there's one in Asheville. There's one in you can, you know, you can. The FDA lets me sell it to any age, anybody.
Okay.
And it's a relaxant. And I have it in candy bars.
But it's probably classified as a supplement or a food product because it's not regulated.
It's supplement.
Right. Okay.
And I have it in candy bars. I have it in hot chocolate. I have it in drinks. And it's my number one selling item. And I love it because I see the young college kids coming in, especially if they're under 21, and they're going to drink Kava to relax instead of alcohol, which has a slew of potential dangers.
Never heard of it. Yeah.
Yes. So now, the Kava bar is between Wendy's and PTA Thrift Shop.
Okay.
Called Crave. And they sell it as well. So I've introduced that in there because my daughter has lost 5 friends since high school to alcohol. She now sells Kava in the yoga studio in the attempt to hope the people will take a different alternative.
Well, and we'll go back in time. I was in elementary school in the early 70s, late 70s. And we had in 5th grade an education program about drugs. It was supposed to be a deterrent to people. And I think out of the 50 or 60 of us that took it, it was a deterrent to 5 of us. And the rest of them knew which ones they wanted to pick out, right? And so, again, it's a culture of somebody wants to escape the tension, the stress, the 3 devices that you're setting in a coffee shop, that being so focused on being alone or internalizing everything and being isolated that people turn too much to drugs and alcohol and other external things to do it rather than to prayer or God or plugging in.
And I think you know this too. If you don't have a strong spiritual path, whatever that path is that appeals to you at this time, it's going to be very hard to stay balanced. And
I would say I heard it on TV. Somebody described it as a God-shaped hole in each of us.
And give me that
thought. A God-shaped hole in each of us. We find God and it fills that spot, or we go looking for other things that just keep going in the hole, but the hole's still too big and nothing else we put there is going to fill it up.
And what I do, when people come, like, tonight because it's the Bernie Sanders, but most nights when people come, before the presentation, before the movie or the music, I brainwash them.
Uh-oh.
And what I say is, look, our brains get dirty out in the world because we're out here in Babylon. We're out here in this in this profit-based world, and there's not much wisdom. So let me kind of run some wisdom through your brain so I can get you ready.
The wisdom's there. The ears are deaf and the eyes are blind.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what I tell them is in different ways. Sometimes I'll show music about it. But this one concept is you're not asked to complete the work, but yet you can't ignore the work. Everyone got 1/7 billionth of the planet to heal. It's called your life. You've been perfectly prepared for it. All the mistakes you made, all the dead ends you went, everything prepared you to heal your 1/7 billionth of the planet. What this massive military, industrial, corporate juggernaut does, you can't fix it all. You can only do your life. But when you do that, you bring in the Creator's energy into your life, and magic happens. And the people that knew this all came from different spiritual paths. Gandhi was Hindu. Muhammad Ali was Muslim. Mr. Rogers was Presbyterian. You know, Martin Luther King was Baptist.
Many paths, but
Mother
there's
Teresa
one way.
Mother was Catholic. Many, many paths realized, and they healed wherever they were sent with love.
Right, and then it's a ripple effect. It's like throwing a pebble on a pond. No matter how small the pebble, it's going to have ripples.
Exactly.
And it's just a matter of how still the pond or how diverse the pond is and agitated as to how far the ripples go and if they're noticed.
Yeah, and you'll never know, but they continue forever. So what I do is in the evenings when people are gathered, I let them know how many of you are feeling depressed, despair, disillusioned by the present. Of course, every hand goes up. I say, well, let me give you a way to view all this that lets you take control of your life, and you just do what you were sent here to do. You can't fix it all.
Right. For me, I always say God's in charge, and that's ultimately I'm supposed to do my part and take care of what I'm responsible for.
Yeah.
But God's in charge.
He's holding the bigger picture, and he'll do the heavy lifting.
He makes plans, and if we'll let him, he'll guide our steps.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to take a break. You're listening to Focus on Business on WCOM-FM, and my guest is Robert Roskind of Oasis of Carrboro, and we'll be right back.
Community radio is supported by listeners like you, organizations and companies in our community. Focus Resources supports Focus on Business and is our underwriter for today's program. We'd like to thank Focus Resources, and if you'd like to learn more about this organization that supports WCFM and underwrites Focus on Business, you can visit their website, focusresourcesinc.com. Thanks to Focus Resources and all the station's underwriters.
Traffic jam. Staring at the faces in a rearview mirror. Looking at the promise of the promised plan. A one kid dreams of fame and fortune. One kid helps pay. Everything she came out.
Focus on Business and WCOM FM are proud to support the Ronald McDonald House of Durham. To learn more about the Ronald McDonald House of Durham, visit their website at www.ronaldhousedurham.org. That's www.ronaldhousedurham.org, or give them a call at 919-281-1065. WCOM-FM and Focus on Business are proud to support Make-A-Wish of Eastern North Carolina, serving the Triangle. Make-A-Wish of Eastern North Carolina is your community Make-A-Wish. To learn more about what Make-A-Wish is doing, visit their website at www.eastnc.wish.org. That's www.eastnc.wish.org, or give them a call at 1-800-432-WISH. That's 1-800-432-9474.
And you're listening to Focus on Business on WCOM-FM, Chapel Hill and Carrboro 103.5. And my guest today is Robert Ruskins, author, social entrepreneur, and we want to talk about the author part of Robert now. So he brought me a book called In the Spirit of Business, a personal interpretation of applying the principles of a Course in Miracles to business. So how did you decide to write this book, and what all's in it? Because I have not had a chance to read it yet.
Well, the book was actually following other books I've written, which is If We're on the Planet to Learn and Teach Unconditional Love,
right?
Agape, pure love, the Creator's love through us. Then that must apply everywhere. So I have a book called In the Spirit of Marriage. Now, that's the most difficult arena yet to learn and teach unconditional love.
I can speak to nothing to that because I've never been married. So okay. I'll leave that one to you.
It is. And then, so if that's the case, then it must be true, I think, for our work life.
Right.
In other words, we're still, even though we have to earn money, we have to worry about our careers, whatever, the main goal of being on the planet is reflected there, too. So how would you use your work life or your business or your career to learn and teach love? You know, and so the book, In the Spirit of Business, which you can get either at my coffee shop or on Amazon, looks at that issue and has chapters on working with people, success, failure, competition versus cooperation.
Money. The thing, you know, we have a lot of problems with a lot,
yeah,
of times.
You know, so
this one is going to be my favorite chapter to read, The Gift of Failure.
It is a gift. One of my businesses years ago, Lee, was funded by venture capitalists. And the venture capitalist told me after he had agreed to put the money up, if you hadn't had a business failure, we wouldn't have put the money up. We have so many people that were presidents of this corporation or vice presidents of this corporation. They've never dealt with failure. They've always had huge amounts of money in the bank to write a check.
Right.
And they said, we won't fund people like that because they have no idea what they're getting into. They're used to a corporation covering their ass.
Nope, that's all right. We all know that CYA term.
Okay. And so.
And that's a creature. So that, yeah. And it, also an anatomical part, so we're good.
Thank you. So, they said that without at least one failure, they as venture capitalists won't fund anybody, because then once you fail, you've learned a lot about things.
And right. Our greatest lessons are often failures. where we failed relationships, failed businesses, failed career decisions, all those kind of things.
And you either take that failure as which always hurts our self-esteem, is always painful. You have to rebuild yourself from that. But it either makes you or breaks you. You know what I mean?
Right.
And as an entrepreneur, it's got to, if you want to succeed, it has to make you. You have to, and like I said, I've failed in three businesses. And the fourth one hit, and then I was able to retire.
Right.
You know, after short.
Those aren't bad odds, though. I mean, if somebody was batting baseball, I think they'd probably take those odds.
Yeah, they're not bad. And So, you know, the failure is a gift. It's a gift to say, and it does hit your self-esteem. Like I had to, what I had to do is after one of the failures, the key failure that happened, I had to make peace with the fact, if you failed in business, does not mean you're a failure as a person.
Right.
And especially as a male who's been trained out of the 50s and 60s and 70s, unfortunately, right. That's changed, that you are what you create, you are what you succeed in business, I realized that I had rigged that up. So I had to go back and remap my inner workings to say, you're not a failure as a human being or as a man because you failed
right.
in business.
Well, and it's an interesting thing because when you ask someone who they are, a lot of times they'll say, I'm a doctor, I'm a plumber. It's like, no, that's what you do. There may be some aspect of who you are in that because of the choice. But who you are is independent of that success or that failure. And people worry about what other people will think about you failing. Well, usually most people are so focused on their own failures, they don't notice yours.
And that was an issue for me. And I thought, you know what? The people that really care about me, they're not going to think any worse of me. Because it wasn't like I gambled it away or I drank it away. And the ones that might judge me, they're the kind of people that you don't really need to have pay much attention
right.
to.
So if you looked back at the three failures, businesses that failed, what were the lessons out of each of those?
The biggest lesson on the first one, which was actually my first nonprofit, the Owner Builder okay. Center in Berkeley, is I did what I mentioned earlier. I allowed my two lieutenants that came on board with me to have more control than I should have.
Right.
And they didn't hold the same vision as me. And because of that, and there were two of them, and I was the guy that brought them on board, I think I gave up too much of my control. And I wasn't following the dictates of my heart.
Well, doesn't that also get to some extent where we've been sort of, and I'll call it programmed, that decisions have to be made by consensus, that someone taking charge and saying, I'm in charge, it's my decision, and yes, okay, you can give me your opinions, but it's my decision, it's my company, it's my nonprofit, it's my vision. And we've sort of been discouraged to take that ownership of that because that's somehow wrong or dysfunctional.
Yeah, and I was 27 at the time, and I had, you know, the school, the nonprofit school had 25 teachers teaching from Marin County down to Santa Cruz, house building,
right.
You know, house remodeling, solar energy, et cetera. So I think the first thing I did with that is I gave up too much of the control to people who were fear-based.
Right.
And they pushed for very conservative decisions when we should have been probably more aggressive. And that was the first one. The second one, I brought in a partner that I didn't do due diligence on.
Okay.
And I didn't know at the time that actually this would then turn from a failure to success. It's the business that let me retire. But it walked right up to a bankruptcy. And I did not know that the man had a drug substance problem.
Okay.
Because when he was under the influence of cocaine, he was incredibly confident. The kind of confidence
right.
you would want with a partner. But I did not give myself the weeks or months I should have to do due diligence on him.
Well, and that's an important thing for our audience to think about is that you do have to, like, if you're going to hire an employee, you do background checks and credit checks and you do all these things. But a lot of times when someone we date or someone we're going to go into business with, we just take them on face value.
That's right.
Yeah. Right? And so I always said, you know, you should ask for three references for who you date to. But, you know, you have to take time to know somebody before you're going to hang your hat or your livelihood or your business and that trust with them and do all that due diligence.
Well, and
sometimes
funny,
you still get bit.
And here's the situation. I thought I was seeing the hand of the Creator guide me there. I'm at a business dinner in Seattle,
uh-huh.
and I'm telling the person I'm with that I'm going to start a company that makes how-to videos.
Okay.
Because I had a school in Berkeley, and I was the number one how-to educator in the country. I'd written a book on how to build your own home. And he said, oh, my best friend's son is a producer, and he wants to produce how-to videos.
Well,
I'm thinking, what's the chance of this happening?
Right. And sometimes it is the hand of God, but it's a different lesson that you thought he wanted you to learn.
Well, and that's what right? happened. So I fly to Minneapolis to meet this man. His father is the second command of AT&T. His other two people that he's close with are head of Jelco Corporation. These are big people. They take me out to the Minneapolis Club. I get involved with them. and later found out about the drug problem, other issues that were going on. And fortunately, we broke apart and I took over the company. And after two incredibly stressful years, the company kicked in. And
right.
So I think the hand of God may have been there directing me. I just didn't. As you know, you think the path to success is a straight line.
And that there are no detours, no speed bumps, no potholes, no running out of gas, all of those kind of things. So, But change and growth and having your business, it's a journey. It's success is not a moment in time. It's a process.
Yeah, it is. And so the books, when I felt like I had had enough business experience after 20 years in several companies, I wrote the book on Spirit of Business. And years ago, we got a call from my publisher, Celestial Arts in Berkeley. Oprah Winfrey's personal manager just called. She bought 150 copies of the book. She's taking her whole staff to a resort.
So you were on Oprah's book list.
No, she took her whole staff to Hawaii and studied the book and said she'd have me on. And I still await the call. And I once kidded my daughter on my tombstone, I want you to put Oprah never called.
Well, it's interesting in that's another thing that comes in that says, okay, here was this opportunity, it didn't materialize, but what do you learn from it, right?
Well, and actually, I don't know what would happen had she. I would have been like Dr. Bob, like Dr. Phil. But I have so much loved the life I've led.
Right.
Going into the ghettos of Jamaica and bringing a message of love through their conscious reggae artist into ghetto schools with, 50
right.
times. Going into maximum security prisons with conscious artists with one message. You teach love behind the walls, you're free.
Right.
And if you're on the outside and you've forgotten to teach love, you walk
the
around
the biggest
in your
prison we're in is the one we impose on ourselves.
Right. And so to go in and then to go into Native American, with the same message, and that is just like the prodigal son. Doesn't matter whether you didn't remember to teach love until you got into prison. And these are maximum security
right.
prisons I was going into in Taylorsville and Morganton and Marion, and telling them, teach love.
Right.
And if you have something to redeem yourself for when those young kids get off that bus the first day in their prison, go to them and bring them into the chapel or into somewhere besides the gangs. So when I look back at my life, I'm thinking, I could have been at Marriott's making $30,000 a gig like
right.
Deepak Chopra or whatever. I think, well, it wasn't the path meant for me or she would call.
Right, and it's the thank God for unanswered prayers, right?
Yeah.
Because he knew what would have happened.
Yeah, my ego probably couldn't have handled it back then.
Yeah, he gives us what we can handle when we can handle it.
Yeah.
So if you had to give, we have like 5 minutes left. First, we want to give out the website for it's oasiscarborough.com.
Mm-hmm.
You can check it out if you're locally or just visit online to see his books that are out there and just learn about social entrepreneurship that way. But in the last 5 minutes, if you had to talk about the biggest life lesson that you've learned through business, through family relationships, through your writing, what would that biggest lesson be?
To find a spiritual discipline, belief, whatever, that allows you when the fears come up, and they're going to come up as long as you're on the planet, they're going to come up.
As long as you're breathing.
As long as you're breathing, that allows you to take those fears and diminish them till you can restore your trust in the Creator's will in your life. That's to me, whether it's in your personal life, your romantic life, whatever, when that fear comes up that you'll never meet the right mate or that you'll never have enough money or that
or whatever. What will people think?
Yeah, what will people think?
I think that's most people's biggest.
Yeah, that's a big one. So when that fear comes up, and it's going to come up with all of us, is that you're able to sit down and restore yourself back to the point of saying, I have a prayer that is answered every day. You want to hear my prayer?
Yes, I do.
Creator, show me every fear, insecurity, and attachment I have that's in the way of serving as an instrument of your peace and love on this planet. And every day the Creator shows me my fear, my insecurities.
And it just flashes before your eyes. Right?
And my attachments. And some days I'll say, yesterday was enough. Give me a break today.
Right.
So I think it's that ability to say, this is being revealed to me so I can heal it, so I can be a clear instrument of peace.
Well, and I will say my prayer, and then a lot of days I say, Lord, it's me. Just keep the line open. I think it's going to be one of those days. I'm not saying amen till I go to bed tonight. So what's on the schedule tonight and the rest of the week? And
well, tonight I have
the phone bank.
Yeah, I got a phone bank for Bernie Sanders. Tomorrow night I have a wonderful woman, Belinda McCree. She runs a retreat center, Clearwater Retreat Center, right outside of Chapel Hill. And she teaches, you know, Ayurvedic meditation, healing, polarity therapy, yoga at her retreat center. It's the Clearwater Retreat Center. She speaks once a week at Oasis, and she does programs once a week there. So she holds the light outside of the village here,
okay,
about 5 miles. And then on Friday night, I have this woman,
right,
Suzette Faith Foster, who's going to be showing the film that was on the Hallmark Hall of Fame this week.
I Hope You Dance.
I Hope You Dance, yeah. And then Saturday night, I got an African drumming group from young men coming to teach the joy of African, you know, drumming.
So how big is your space? How many people can be there at each event each night?
Well,
they have to get there early?
Some nights, it depends. I can hold comfortably about 35 to 45.
Okay.
When I bring in people from outside the area, sometimes I've had up to 60, but you got a lot of people sitting on cushions on the floor. So about 35, 45 people. Everything is free. I mean, not the food and drink,
right,
but all the events are free except New Year's
no
Eve.
No admission charge.
Yeah, I have a conscious New Year's Eve. We all
know what
an unconscious New Year's Eve looks like.
So tell us about a conscious New Year's Eve in the last minute or so that we have.
Well, it's the Barred Owls singing group. They're very high level, very inspirational.
The Barred Owls?
Barred Owls.
Okay.
Right before midnight, we do a short little 10-minute meditation where people put in their hopes for the coming year into a bowl. And then we burn that, and we do that, and we have, it's not a drunken New Year's Eve.
They're going to have kava instead of alcohol.
I sell alcohol there, but it's really not a place to get hammered.
Well, that's good, because
yeah,
on New Year's Eve, there's going to be enough of those people out there causing chaos out
yeah
there for us. Well, I want to thank you for being on the show. If they want to get more of your books, they can search you on Amazon.com at Robert Roskin, R-O-S-K-I-N-D.
Mm-hmm.
And look up the In the Spirit of Business book, or In the Spirit of Marriage, How to Build a House. I noticed that was still,
yeah, that's another
was
book
still out there too. And I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
And Lee, thank you for helping me get out the message.
It's my pleasure. Okay, everyone, until next time, stay focused on the important things.
Along the straight and narrow.